Ao hea o ko e ko ka aha. Inahe kuleana i mua o kea aha ho o kolokolo ki e ki e hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoi mai, e maliu mai, i lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 20067, State of Hawaii versus Victoria Sitoafainga, arguing for the petitioner, Hayden Aluli, arguing for the respondent, Richard Rost, argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During the course of our argument, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'd like to ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing.
May it please the court, Aloha C.J. Ruchtenwald and Associate Justices of the Hawaii State Supreme Court. Mahalo for accepting this case of further review and hearing oral arguments on the merits. I am Hayden Aluli, and I represent Petitioner Defendant Appellant Victoria Sitoafainga.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy of Prosecuting Attorney Richard B. Ross for Respondent, State of Hawaii.
All right, thank you, Mr. Aluli and Mr. Rost. Just to confirm, you each have 30 minutes for your argument. Mr. Aluli, you reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go and then a warning at the end of your 30 minutes as well. Mr. Rost, we will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. And again, at the end of your time, we will have both a visual and an audible signal to let you know that your time has come to a conclusion. Mr. Aluli, please proceed.
Thank you. This case raises the sole issue of whether the trial court committed reversible error in denying petitioner's motion to defer her no contest plea to two misdemeanors under Chapter 853 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. In denying petitioner's motion, the trial court found two requirements out of the three requirements against petitioner. One, the trial court found that petitioner appeared likely to engage in a criminal course of conduct again. And two, the ends of justice and the welfare of society required that she shall presently suffer the penalty imposed by law. My argument is structured in two parts. First, I will demonstrate how the trial court clearly exceeded the bounds of reason when it found petitioner is likely to engage in future criminality. Second, I will demonstrate how the trial court disregarded rules and principles of law or practice to the substantial detriment to petitioner. But a brief summary of the procedural facts. In December 2017, Maui prosecutors charged petitioner with four counts. Counts one and three charged sexual assault in the third degree, Class C felonies. Count two charged sexual assault in the first degree, a Class A felony. And count four charged custodial interference in the second degree, a misdemeanor. The complainant was a 12-year-old girl. In March 2019, petitioner and the prosecution settled the case as follows. Counts one and three were dismissed, and count two, which had alleged, quote, sexual penetration, close quote, was amended to sexual assault in the fourth degree, a misdemeanor. Petitioner would enter a no contest plea to the amended charge in count two, quote, sexual contact, close quote, and count four, custodial interference as charged. In January 2020, at petitioner's motion to defer acceptance of her no contest plea and sentencing proceeding, the trial court possessed the following information regarding petitioner that clearly supported the granting of the deferral motion. She was a youthful 27-year-old first-time offender with no criminal history. Throughout her educational career, she was, quote, never suspended or expelled and never had any issues with attendance her grades, or behavioral problems, close quote. She had been a member of the National Guard for 12 years, from 2008 to 2020. The pre-SI, the pre-sentence investigation report, pointed out, one, defendant had no history of prior delinquency or criminal activity, or has led a law-abiding life for a substantial period of time before the commission of the present crime. Two, the character and attitude and history of the defendant indicate that she is unlikely to commit another crime. Three, the defendant has a history of stable employment, and her present employment is stable and satisfying in nature. Four, the defendant has a good support system of friends, family, or other significant persons which would aid in her adjustment. And five, the defendant is engaged in employment which would be seriously or adversely affected by a conviction.
Mr. Aluli, Justice Edens and then Justice Wilson have questions. Justice Edens.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Aluli, part of the plea agreement was a stipulation to a factual basis. When the amendment to Sex 4 came down, there was a stip to a factual basis, but there wasn't a recitation of the conduct associated with that amendment placed on the record. So how is the court to decide or have any idea for sentencing purpose what that factual basis to support the amended Sex 4 charges?
Well, first off, Justice, a no contest plea under the Hawaii Criminal Rules of Procedure, there needs to need no ascertainment on the record that a factual basis exists to corroborate the offense. The Hawaii rules have adopted the federal rules of criminal procedure, where the federal rules recognize situations where a defendant can actually say he or she is innocent, but is entering a no-contest plea to save face, not to have to admit guilt, to save time and energy, but to preserve resources.
Mr. Lilly, the court at sentencing doesn't have to go along with that and perhaps assume that the person's not guilty of the charge. The judge reads a pre-sentence report, sees the investigative reports, which are typically associated with the crime, and makes a decision. Now, in this particular case, you know, if you commit the act of sexual penetration, you have also committed sexual contact because it's an included offense. So it seems to me that the conduct supporting the factual basis for sexual assault in the fourth degree could have been sexual penetration. And if that's the case, would this be an unlawful sentence?
Well, no, Your Honor, because I think as a matter of statutory definition, under 707-700, sexual contact is defined, quote, means any touching other than acts of, quote, sexual penetration, close quote. By definition, one of the elements of sexual assault in the first degree necessarily excluded, as a matter of law, the factual basis of sexual penetration. She was neither charged with it, she never pled guilty or no contest to it. And the trial court, and you know, the ICA probably got confused there too, that it would be denial due process to sentence her with these allegations when the elements that she pled no contest to excluded them.
But are you suggesting that sexual assault in the fourth degree is not an included offense of sexual assault in the first degree?
I am admitting it is. But when the plea settlement occurred and the government amended the sexual assault in the first degree, the allegation and element of sexual penetration, down to sexual assault in the fourth degree, which has the element of sexual contact, but by definition excludes sexual penetration as a matter of law, that it would be a denial of due process to sentence Ms. The petitioner as if there was a factual basis that wasn't included in the elements. And I think as a matter of law, the trial court and the IC erred with that analysis.
Well, it seems to me that perhaps your position is that when there's a case of included offenses, and I understand your position about sex four and the penetration element, but you know, when a judge reads a pre-sentence report, the report includes the investigation, and the investigation is going to have the charged conduct. It's not going to necessarily have included offense conduct. And from your position, it seems to me that the judge cannot consider what the judge reads in the pre-sentence report. And let me just give an example here. Let's say there was a manslaughter charge. And it was a punch and the person hits their head on the sidewalk, which is not an uncommon situation for manslaughter. The prosecution in its wisdom gives the individual a misdemeanor deal, an assault in the third degree deal. And then the judge at sentencing says, hey, look, you know, your actions caused the death of this person. And I'm gonna sentence you to a year for that. And then the defense gets up and hollers, whoa, wait, wait, judge, this is only a reckless bodily injury case. It seems that your argument sort of would support that the judge can't factor in the fact that the person in the example I just used died, that they can only say, hey, look, you caused reckless bodily injury. You didn't cause the death of this person. Can you try to reconcile? Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
Well, first, thank you, Judge Justice. I think that hypo is a little bit different as applied to this case, because in the manslaughter or the lesser included statute doesn't expressly exclude an element of manslaughter. In this case, sexual assault in the first degree alleges, quote, sexual penetration, close quote. Sexual assault in the fourth degree necessarily excludes, as a matter of definition, sexual penetration. And that's the clear difference. And that's why when the petitioner pleaded no contest to sexual contact, as a matter of law, there can be no consideration of any allegation of sexual penetration because of the definition and the elements which she pled no contest to, which she was charged, and which the court accepted her no contest plea. Now, maybe it might have been more cautious for me to put a factual basis when she pleaded no contest. But to me, as a matter of law, it was unnecessary. Like going back to your manslaughter, perhaps the defense counsel should have made a factual basis as to the lesser included facts. But in this petitioner's case, because the statute necessarily excludes in sexual contact, excludes sexual penetration, the trial court cannot consider these allegations as a matter of law.
Mr. Aluli, Justice Wilson has a question.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Aluli, I'm interested in your point about how it seemed to you straightforward that your client was not pleading to sexual penetration. And I wanted to ask you about the nature of your remedy that you're requesting, because would it be your position that when you advised your client about the ramifications of this plea, your client understood that you would not be held responsible for the allegations of penetration? And if that's the case, are you considering as a remedy that you be allowed to withdraw that plea?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that remedy or that needs to take place, because when the government and the defense negotiated by plea agreement, where the government amended the sexual assault from the first degree to the fourth degree, the government's bound by it, and it's bound by the elements of what the offense they charged and what the offense petitioner pled no contest to.
Was that, so I'm sorry to interrupt you, but was that the understanding of your client when you entered into this plea agreement, do you think?
Well, Your Honor, I think I can't speak as to attorney-client communication, frankly, with all due respect, Your Honor. Okay, but I just think that as a matter of law, that when a government amends a certain element of an offense down to an element of offense that necessarily excludes the prior amendment, that as a matter of due process, I'm talking about adequate notice and meaningful hearing, that the defendant, whether the government or the trial judge, is precluded from adding on elements that were neither or expressly excluded from the offense of conviction.
Mr. Aluli, well, what could the judge do in terms of considering the circumstances of the offense? I'm not certain what, you know, the judge had the report. The report talked at some length about the alleged penetration, also talked at length about the text messaging that had gone back and forth. What exactly could the judge consider in trying to assess the seriousness of this conduct and the likelihood of its reoccurring under your point of view?
Well, the sentencing court, the trial court, tried to substantiate its finding that there would be a likelihood of reoffending, but I don't think any of the factors that the court cited can raise an inference of future criminal conduct. You know, just the fact that a no contest plea was entered, which the federal courts, as well as the Hawaii Rules of Criminal Procedure, accept, that a defendant can plead no contest and claim innocence. That's called basically an Alford plea. In this case, the defendant was walking a very fine line, trying to basically have the trial court accept her no contest plea of sexual assault in the fourth degree and grant the deferral, but at the same time, standing by her right under the an Alford plea or a no contest plea, that plea would not be used against her. Now, I think the trial court abused its discretion by exceeding the scope of reasoning when it used the text messages and it used the allegation of sexual penetration to support its finding that the petitioner would engage in future acts and reoffend. And I don't think it's relevant. I don't think it really raises the kind of concerns that this court expressed in State versus Medeiros a couple of years ago, when this court really found that the same trial court, the same judge, had denied a motion for deferral, and all of her concerns as far as why Mr. Medeiros would reoffend were found to be an abuse of discretion.
Mr. Aluli, how is it, or what's your theory for why the judge would be precluded from considering the text messages, according to the pre-sentence report, you know, 16,000 text messages back and forth of sexually explicit nature? Doesn't that go to the question of whether this was truly a one-time situational event or something that really played out over a fairly lengthy period of time and that might indicate a greater risk of repeat criminality in the future? And then if we could address that.
Well, this is a situational offense concerning one child over a course of 4 months. Now, the trial court even recognized that almost 16,000 text messages certainly did not all include sexually explicit exchanges. And in fact, the trial court only quoted a few of them. And also conceded that not all of them were explicitly sexual in nature. But nevertheless, someone that's not in this, in my view, because it's a first offense and because it was situational in that it concerned one complainant, that the court would be exceeding grounds of reasons to say that would raise an inference of future criminality when you look at the total character reference and the petitioner's total background and lack of criminal history, and you weigh that, and it cannot overcome her lack of criminal history, which is the best indicator of future criminality.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly. Justice Nakayama, followed by Justice McKenna.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Aluli, suppose someone goes on a spree and in the course of a month shoplifts expensive items from five different department stores, and they come to a plea agreement. It's a first time, the person doesn't have a record, and agrees to plead to one charge, theft two, because the person took expensive things. So are you saying that the sentence, now we're not talking about sentencing, we're talking about a dank, which is a special category for people who, well, you know what the statute says, who are not likely to offend, who deserve this grace from the court. So if the party pleads to just one offense, are you saying the court can't take into consideration that the person initially was charged with four other offenses in determining whether they're allowed to grant a dank? You know, in part of the calculation that they won't offend again. Because there's a lot of other circumstances besides the text messages. There are the hickeys on the chest. There are other things that indicate this one contact is not a one-time thing. So why can't a judge take into consideration other things in not sentencing, but in determining whether they're allowed this great benefit of a dank?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think when you look at, let's say, the shopping situation in Hypo, many, many shoplifting, though each and every one of them, each of them is a criminal offense. You look at the text messaging, none of that, while admittedly highly inappropriate, none of the text messages violated any law or any statute. None of them. Of course, it's in the context of, let's say, you know, the prejudicial nature of it. They did not violate.
Aren't there other things that a person can do that would indicate to a judge whether the person would likely to engage in, whether it was a one-time thing, that aren't necessarily crimes? You say they have to be crimes in order to give the judge the indication whether or not the person is likely to offend again?
I'm saying that when you look at the context of this case, where the text messages, not all 16,000 were sexually explicit.
Well, no.
I'm saying that.
Yeah.
But and I'm saying, like, there was a denial, as in the pre-sentence report, as to the hickeys. In other words, the petitioner's situation was she didn't want to go to trial, although she believed she was innocent. You look at the pre-sentence report, an allegation that first arose because the guardian looked into the complainant's phone, and there's never really any admission at all regarding petitioner committing the hickeys or the
you know, that's hard to,
the pictures.
It's hard to swallow that she didn't admit anything when you look at the text messages and what they said. There's a disconnect there.
Well, and the number, you know, of a lot of, thank you, yes. But, you know, it is just viral entertainment, Your Honor. I mean, a lot of people go on the internet and they express things on text messages, but it doesn't necessarily, there's no evidence of actual sexual penetration or contact. All those text messages were exchanges, yes, highly inappropriate, but nothing illegal about them. Yes, and I see how the trial court in this case felt very uncomfortable. And looking at petitioner's overall, her 27 years of being a contributing member of society, and her one huge mistake, a good person making a very bad choice, in the context of the benefit of the legislature wanting to give benefits because it's in society's best interest for rehabilitation rather than punishment, that the court really skewed her view. She exercised her discretion. And that's really problematic with a certain trial court because it appears she has a track record of having difficulty looking at the policy, looking at the benefit, first-time offenders, the chance to rehabilitate themselves. In this case, there was ample room to sentence within the sentence of to the court gave her 1 year. But also, to have that record as a scarlet letter for the rest of her life, weighing the total total character and reputation, I think is a piece of discussion, even giving those inappropriate text messages to her.
Mr. Aluli, Justice McKenna has a question, followed by Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Aluli, I understand that one of your arguments has been that the trial court denied the DANC based on uncharged conduct. I understand that your argument, I believe your argument was that the uncharged conduct was sexual penetration. But I'm wondering also, with respect to the text messages, did you ever argue as to whether or not uncharged conduct could have also been electronic enticement of a minor based on the text messages?
It was never provided as far as notice by the government that they were even moving toward that allegation. So the defense never were given notice where it could have an adequate opportunity to submit a defense to that. It never, in fact, just you're the first, I guess, jurist that raised that issue. In our view, in all the records below, no one raised the issue that this was an electronic enticement of a minor.
Thank you.
Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Aluli, I would be interested in your description of how the court should analyze what you have focused on as a kind of legally significant change in the factual predicate for the charge. In other words, I think your position is since the factual basis for this charge necessarily excluded penetration, it had an illegal effect. But what does that mean? Do you take the position that the court was to assume that the charge of assault in the first degree was to be addressed as though she was presumed to be not guilty? Or are you suggesting that somehow the change constituted a form of an acquittal? I mean, what is a legal basis upon which you're suggesting that the court would not be able to consider the factual basis? And if that's the case, are you saying that the court should have completely ignored the allegations of penetration, despite the fact that it was in the pre-sentence report, which apparently was referred to without objection?
I think as a matter of law, Your Honor, when the government amends to a certain offense that necessarily excludes certain elements, in this case, sexual penetration, it would be a denial of due process to use those allegations against a defendant because she was neither charged with such conduct, and she was never, in my view, found guilty of them because it was necessarily excluded from the elements of conviction. When a defendant enters a no contest plea, all of the elements are basically the court can convict on them. In this case, there was no element of sexual penetration at all. And I think it would be a denial of procedural and substantive due process to use that against her, even in this special DANC kind of benefit, Justice Nakayama, because it would just go against all due process concerns of of being convicted or negative consequences with uncharged offenses or conduct. So I think because of the plea negotiations and the amendment, I think the court, the trial court, needs to look at that in the context of not being able to use it against the petitioner in denying the benefit of receiving a second chance with their life. And I think just the peculiar facts of this case, because of the exclusion of the sexual penetration allegation, that is a matter of law that must be the ultimate outcome. Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Lulli. I just wanted to ask one follow-up, and then there was a stipulation that there was a factual basis to sexual assault in the fourth degree, which is sexual contact, correct?
That's correct.
So can the judge not at least consider the factual circumstances around that sexual contact, even if they may also constitute sexual penetration? I'm still trying to understand how the judge is supposed to evaluate the facts of what actually took place. And I think back to the Hussein case, where we observed that when there's a no contest plea in the sentencing context, the pre-sentence report is a vitally important piece of information for the judge to be able to issue a sentence that actually reflects the conduct. I'm still trying to understand what exactly this judge could take into account about what happened in that room upstairs at the Boys and Girls Clubs back in March, I think, of 2017.
Okay, well, going back to what happened in the March, Your Honor, it had to do with alleged sexual contact, okay? And the sexual contact, according to I guess, my memory, alleged kissing or some other type of touching in intimate sexual parts.
I thought that was count one. That was count one, Mr. Lulli, was the kissing. Count two was
right.
The penetration that was then reduced to a sexual assault. Four, although apparently referring to the same conduct. So what could the judge? What was the judge supposed to be able to take into account with regard to what actually happened on that occasion?
I think in this particular circumstances, when the elements of what the petitioner is convicted of necessarily excluded a certain allegation of sexual penetration, as a matter of law, that is off the table. And the sentencing court must take only allegations of element of contact that necessarily excluded penetration. That was the bargain the petitioner struck with the government. I believe the government should be bound by that agreement, and necessarily so should the trial court be bound by that. And it would just be inappropriate to use these allegations when they are necessarily excluded from the offense of conviction.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Lulli. We've gone over your time a bit, but I will give you some time in rebuttal. Anything further at this time, or shall we hear from Mr. Ross next?
I'll wait and do my time in rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lulli. Mr. Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to respond first to something Mr. Lulli said, which is his characterization of this incident as, quote, one huge mistake. That's not accurate, and that attempts to paint a very misleading picture of what actually happened here. The timeline of this involves, as the court has referred to, the 16,000 text messages. Those were sent between January and April of 2017. Then in March was the incident upstairs at the Boys and Girls Club that was the foundation for count two, which alleged the digital penetration of the victim by the petitioner. Then 7 months after that was the custodial interference in October of 2017. So what did the circuit court have in front of it? It had essentially a 10-month pattern of conduct by the petitioner of conduct that ranged from not illegal but inappropriate to crimes. And this is not simply a one, the petitioner has repeatedly characterize this case as a first-time offense. And yes, the state is happy to concede she did not have any convictions prior to this case, but she committed two crimes and they were separated by 7 months. So it's not accurate to simply paint her as this first-time offender. And that goes into the types of offenders who are supposed to receive the benefits of Chapter 853, the first-time offenders, the accidental or situational offenders. There's nothing about these crimes, particularly sexual assault of a 12-year-old minor, that is accidental or situational. You can't really characterize it that way. So when the circuit court was presented with all of this, it was not an unreasonable conclusion to draw, one, the petitioner might offend again based on her 10-month pattern of conduct, and two, that the ends of justice and the welfare of society required the petitioner to pay the penalty. It's an abuse of discretion standard. It's not supposed to be necessarily what you or I would do if we were sitting where the trial court was. Mr. Chief Justice.
Oh, sorry. We respond to Mr. Aluli's suggestion that the state, through the plea bargain that it negotiated with the defendant, in effect took off the table any reference to or the potential for the circuit court to rely on sexual penetration having occurred back in March of 2017. So if I understand his argument, the charge was amended to sex assault 4, which specifically excludes the element of penetration. Therefore, the court could not consider penetration, and yet the court did so. What's your response to that argument?
Well, first of all, the first part of my response is the circuit court was not bound to only consider the charged conduct. The circuit court was allowed to consider the entire situation holistically, and the pre-sentence report has substantial evidence that act of digital penetration occurred. So it was not an abuse of discretion to look at that information, regardless of what the charge petitioner was being sentenced for, and consider that those factual allegations as part of the analysis under Chapter 853-1. That's the first part. The second part is that petitioner pleaded no contest to count two. Count two alleged one thing and one thing only, and that was an act of digital penetration. While the amendment reduced that to sex assault 4, lesser included, that was still the charge. That was still the only factual allegation. So it's not reasonable to tell the circuit court you can no longer consider the factual allegations in the indictment that the petitioner pleaded no contest to, just because the charge was reduced. I mean, I think the court's well aware that in plea deals, the state often reduces the degree of an offense as part of a plea deal. And if we adopted Mr. Aluli's argument, whenever that happened and someone moved for a dank, it seems like the circuit court would have nothing to consider anymore. And I don't think that can be the result.
Very well. Justice Wilson has a question. Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Ross, I know that you are certainly aware of, and I'm sure would respect the proposition that a sentencing court cannot rely on uncharged crimes. That is a proposition. And therefore, the prior history of uncharged crimes has been addressed in our case law, not the least of which is in Mikasa. You'll recall that there was a conviction for a series of drug offenses, and the court decided that it was a conspiracy. And on that basis, the sentencing was reduced because of the error committed by the court in assuming an additional charge, you know, the charge of conspiracy. So in this case, can you help me with why it's different? I understand that we have the same set of facts. Of course, there was a similar set of facts in Mikasa too. And we also have a set of facts that involve I guess you could say, change. Now, you're I think your view is it wasn't that much of a change. I mean, she was still charged with penetration, but is that really the way that you think we are required to analyze it, that despite the amendment to a charge that specifically excludes penetration, we should nonetheless assume that it happened? So how do you distinguish Mikasa?
Well, I guess as to the question of whether or not you have to assume it happened, I don't think the trial court had to assume it happened. I think it was within the trial court's discretion to look at the pre-sentence investigation and everything in front of the trial court and say, I think this happened. I'm going to consider that as part of ruling on this bank motion. As to distinguishing the sentencing cases, State versus O'Shea.
Well, I mean, I'm still interested in how you would interpret that in terms of the nature of the charge and the amendment. In other words, as Justice McKenna brought up, what if the sentencing judge just decided you're enticing a minor? You could be convicted of this offense under these facts. Would you suggest that it would be appropriate for the sentencing judge to bring up this additional charge that perhaps the facts could be based on?
Well, I don't think it would necessarily be appropriate to bring up an additional charge, but I think it would be completely appropriate to look at those facts and how those behaviors by the defendant may or may not influence the factors under Chapter 853-1.
I see. So you're suggesting the facts could be considered, but it would be out of bounds for the sentencing court to consider that assault. It would be fair to say the sentencing court shouldn't consider that assault one was committed, right?
Well, I think when you start going further afield from what the actual charges are, then sure, you can run into an abuse of discretion if you don't have a factual basis for what the circuit court is considering. I would agree with you on that. I would draw a distinction between the sentencing cases and this case because the sentencing principles are not necessarily applicable in the Dank context. But I mean, the ICA cited State versus Oshiro, which talks about how a Dank plea is not a conviction or a sentence. So I don't think the principles from sentencing can automatically be imported into the Dank context, especially.
Okay, so in your view, then we can, if it's a Dank, it would be your position that we should give more flexibility to the court so that the court can charge uncharged offenses in the context of a Dank. Is that right?
Well, I think the circuit court is entitled to some discretion, particularly when ruling on a Dank. Now, as to how far that can be stretched to uncharged conduct, that's a difficult question. But I don't think the answer is this case. I don't think the circuit court strained her discretion beyond the breaking point in what she looked at, especially considering it was all supported by.
How could you? Maybe we're just interpreting facts differently. I want to make sure we've got the facts. I have the facts correctly. There's no question that she sentenced with the idea that penetration took place, right? Isn't that straightforward from the record?
Are we talking about sentencing or denying the Dank?
Sentencing.
Sentencing.
I mean, she looked at the pre-sentence report, and when she made the determination about. Well, in any case, yes. I think I'm referring to sentencing, that she took it into consideration with the sentencing, that penetration occurred.
She may have considered in sentencing, although I note that the sentence isn't on appeal here. So I'm not sure that what happened on sentencing is before the court.
Well, I mean, that's an important distinction. So your feeling is that it may not have been appropriate for sentencing, but it was appropriate in terms of denying the DAG, and denying the DAG shouldn't be considered a sentence.
I think it was definitely appropriate on denying her DAG, because I think the circuit court needs to be allowed to look at everything before it and make its determination as to whether or not the factors under 853-1 have been satisfied. Sentencing, I haven't really developed a position on that because it wasn't on appeal, but I would say that I still think that the circuit court should be allowed to look at what the indictment actually alleges.
Was there some communication with the government and the defendant so that she understood that the decision on the Dank really didn't pertain to her sentencing?
I don't know of anything in the record on that point.
Very well. Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Mr. Ross, you know, I'm trying to figure out on what basis did the circuit court find that the defendant did not meet the factor of is not likely to engage in criminal course of conduct. And was it relying just on the fact that there was, from what I see, the circuit court was saying, have you truly taken responsibility and apologized? I guess, does it appear that you're unlikely to engage in such a criminal course of conduct again? With whom? This victim? Or was there any evidence that this defendant had engaged in this type of conduct with other minors before, or even after this victim, perhaps with someone else?
I'm not aware of anything in the record suggesting multiple victims beyond this one, Your Honor.
Okay, so what was the circuit court's finding as to that second factor? Just the fact that she had not taken responsibility and apologized? Well, that's what I seem to see here.
I think that was part of it. I'm not sure the circuit court broke up its analysis into two clear segments when it was talking about the two Dank factors. I do think, yeah, he certainly alluded to whether or not the defendant had taken responsibility and apologized. Although I think part of that, I think the text messages go into that as well, and just the general pattern of conduct, which suggests, you know, criminal behavior that was not simply a one-time incident.
And so based on that, this defendant would be likely to engage in a criminal course of conduct, either with this CW or with someone else.
Well, I think when the circuit court looked at everything that transpired in this case, it was not an abuse of discretion to say this person may commit another offense. This was a long term. The circuit court used the term grooming at one point, and I think that's a fair characterization of what happened here. And when you start talking about grooming, it's not unreasonable to conclude a person who does that might commit a crime in the future.
Right. And so, you know, that you actually raise a really good point, because the sexual assault of a minor cases that we've seen here, I can't remember one that didn't involve some sort of long-term relationship with an adult. And yet I don't see the legislature having excluded sexual assault of a minor from the legislature has seen fit to exclude many different kinds of offenses from eligibility for Dagger Dank. But they haven't included this when it, you know, almost always involves some sort of relationship between the adult and the minor, you know, other type of relationship. So, it seems that, I guess there could just be a one-time incident after the grooming, but isn't it for the legislature to decide whether or not this offense should be completely excluded?
Oh, it absolutely is. And I would note that the trial court clearly noted that this offense was not excluded. She noted that on the record and then proceeded to analyze the other factors.
Mr. Rust, do you think that we should, going forward, require some statement of a factual basis or offer proof from the government so that we don't have these kinds of, misunderstandings or potential misunderstandings? Again, there seems to have been at least Mr. Aluli's argument is that there was a very different understanding of what the consequence of the plea was and what she was agreeing that she wasn't contesting. Is there something we should do going forward in terms of requiring, for example, a proffer of some kind in these circumstances, or in a guilty plea case, actually some explicit factual basis or acknowledgement on the record of that basis?
Well, I think, you know, on a guilty plea, I think that's a lot easier. I think the question, because we've heard Mr. Aluli talk about how the defendant doesn't want to admit guilt. So if in a dank situation, if the government is being forced to put, is being required to put something on the record, I don't know how that will work, because you're going to have the defendant objecting to whatever, or potentially objecting to whatever it is the government is trying to put on the record as the basis, or refusing to go along with it at a minimum. So I'm not sure how that would work. And I hesitate to suggest that that would make things any smoother when it comes to the circuit court's discretion on banks.
So I think just perhaps Justice Sittins and I have the same question, but, you know, I wanted to ask, you think that, you know, that we ended up ultimately having this discussion and this conversation here. So at some point, there's going to be, the disconnect is going to come come to the fore. Shouldn't it come to the fore, like, at the time the plea is being accepted, as opposed to after the dank has been adjudicated and then all the way up on appeal? And then I'll turn it over to Justice Sittins, but if you could respond to that first.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I certainly would agree with you from a timing perspective. It makes a lot more sense to resolve it in front of the circuit court. I still don't know how that would work. And I mean, that, of course, will be up to the court if you're going to craft some sort of new procedure for that. It does concern me, though, because since the whole point of the dank is essentially saying or no contest, please, is saying that they're not going to contest it and that they're not going to admit or deny anything, essentially. I just don't know how mechanically that would work.
Well, in this case, the government could have proffered that it was prepared to show there were acts of sexual penetration. The defendant could have said, Your Honor, we strenuously object. That is not appropriate. That should not and cannot be taken into account by the court. And the court could have then tried to resolve that dispute at the time of the plea.
So that's certainly a legitimate procedure that you're suggesting, Mr. Chief Justice. And I just hesitate to get into a situation where the circuit courts are being forced to, like, make factual findings, because that now you don't want them to be conducting essentially a mini trial over the government's proffer versus the objections being raised by the defendant.
Very well, Mr. Justice Sittins.
Thank you, Chief Justice. And we do overlap on the questions. And I'm just wondering, Mr. Rossman, what does it really mean then to stipulate to a factual basis? I mean, what does that mean?
I would say it means that the circuit court can consider what's in the indictment and that there's some factual basis to support that, and it can base its ruling on the dank on that.
But the defense is stipulating to a factual basis. What are they stipulating to, and what are you stipulating to, if nothing's recited on the record?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a difficult question to answer, because you have a defendant who doesn't want to admit anything and who just wants to plead no contest.
Well, so, you know, is it really the defendant's fault there? You know, you gave a pretty generous plea agreement. I think we can all agree with it. And I look at Mr. Lulley's client, and one reason she accepted the plea agreement, because she was facing just an absolute large chunk of the rest of her life in jail. So it's not surprising that somebody might take a misdemeanor deal when they're innocent. You controlled it. You allowed the ability to do a guilty plea or a no contest plea, right? I mean, so if you give the defendant that choice, they're always going to take a no contest versus guilty, and then you're left with stipulating to a factual basis that none of us know really what that means. So I'm just wondering, how's a judge supposed to figure this all out on how to sentence somebody if there's no basis on the record for really anything other than, well, she or he is pleading to sex four.
I think you look at the pre-sentence report and the indictment and everything else in front of the trial court, and the trial court just has to exercise its discretion based on the record in front of it. And I agree with you that if there was a clear factual basis put on the record, that would certainly make things clearer, at least at some level.
Yeah, again, my question, in fact, the plea agreement, following up on Justice Edens, the plea agreement says the defendant stipulates, agrees to a factual basis to support these charges. Again, you know, it's not apparent to me what that provision means, given what we've heard today. And one answer might be that the government would proffer certain facts that it's prepared to prove, or that it asserts it can prove at the time of sentencing. The defendant can, of course, disagree with those facts, but more to the point, in a case like this, where apparently there's a disagreement over what is even the appropriate scope of the judge's consideration in sentencing, that could be fleshed out in the beginning, or at least considered. But anything further on this point, Mr. Ross, before you move on to the remainder of your argument?
No, nothing further on this point. Thank you.
All right, please continue.
Just very briefly, I'd like to point out that this entire argument regarding the circuit court supposedly considering uncharged conduct should probably be waived, because if you look at the opening brief, it's not actually raised in the point of error. And to the extent it's raised in the argument, it's a different argument. Petitioner contended in her opening brief that the circuit court had improperly gotten the digital penetration allegation out of count one, which was dismissed. And the state pointed out in its answer brief, that's not true. The digital penetrations were in count two, the count she pleaded no contest to. And then in the reply brief, we get for the first time this argument that the circuit court shouldn't have considered the digital penetration allegations because the degree was reduced from sex assault one to sex assault four. And we all know you can't raise an argument for the first time in reply. This court said that numerous times. So I would submit that should be waived, and just to point that out. The other argument here that—
Mr. Rust, if you would, do you feel that the circuit court here did impermissibly consider a lack of remorse or lack of acknowledgement of responsibility? There seemed to be a comment by the circuit court that I think was quoted earlier. What's your read of that comment? And did the court go beyond what it could in these circumstances?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I have a few things to say about that. It's, you know, we're talking about the state versus Kaminao rule, which again is a sentencing rule, not a Dank rule. So I'm not sure that it should apply when we're talking to a Dank for a couple of reasons. I mean, if we look at the language of Kaminao, it talks about how, quote, a sentencing court may not impose an enhanced sentence based on a defendant's refusal to admit guilt with respect to an offense, the conviction of which he intends to appeal. That's Kaminao 103 Hawaii at 316. So both those elements aren't here. There's no enhanced sentence. There's a denial of a Dank, which is not the same thing. But then Kaminao is talking about an intention to appeal your conviction. Well, that's also not part of what's happening here, because when you plead no contest, that you're not continuing to insist you're innocent. You're not saying I'm going to fight my conviction all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. You're pleading no contest. So the analysis, I mean, the way the court got to that rule in Kaminao and its progeny doesn't really make sense here. Even if you were to say yes, we want Kaminao to apply to Dank cases, I still don't think it applies, because the court has held in Kaminao that if the record shows the circuit court didn't know more than address the factor of remorsefulness as it bore on defendant's rehabilitation, then the court's reference to a persistent claim of innocence isn't a problem. So, and that's all the circuit court did here at most. It was a passing reference to are you remorseful? And it was not a situation that had come up in other cases where the circuit court says, essentially, I'm going to throw the book at you unless you admit you did it. There was no back and forth. It was just, are you showing remorse? Did you take responsibility? I think those are appropriate factors for a circuit court to consider on a Dank, where you're trying to analyze whether this person is going to commit another crime in the future or whether the ends of justice require them to pay the penalty, whether they've shown remorse it bears on that. So that would be my response to why I don't think the circuit court improperly considered remorse.
Very well. Anything further for the court at this time?
The only thing I would close by saying is the circuit court had a lot of evidence in front of it that suggested that the ends of justice required petitioner to pay the penalty. This court has quoted the legislature as finding that people who sexually prey on children are an extreme threat to public safety in State versus Bonnie. And that's what the circuit court said. It said it needed to protect the children and little girls in society. And based on the allegations here, that was a reasonable conclusion and not an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Rose, thank you for your argument. Mr. Aluli, your rebuttal.
Thank you. You know, even assuming that the petitioner showed no remorse, I don't think that that is an inference that should the circuit court rely upon for future criminality. That should raise no inference. Someone can stand up there and basically say, I'm innocent, as she's entitled to do with no contest, please. And still that shouldn't be discounted or used against her on that finding of future reoffending or criminality. But the record does show that the defendant did apologize. And it's found in Record on Appeal, Docket 232-3. It is the second supplemental pre-sentence investigation report. And obviously it was overlooked by the court, but she said, quote, or wrote, quote, I would also like to ask for forgiveness from you, the court, my family, friends, and to the minor and her family. I never intended this to happen. And from the bottom of my heart, I'm truly sorry for everything that I have caused. I take full responsibility for my actions and I regret them wholeheartedly. But in my view, first off, this DANC procedure is coupled with a sentencing procedure. United States versus Bosser, a Ninth Circuit case coming out of the District of Hawaii, 866F2nd 315, 1989, quoted that the Hawaii deferred acceptance rule constitutes a punishment as it gives a defendant an opportunity to serve a probation-like sentence that restricts defendant's liberty. So trying to decipher that, no, it's a motion, it's not a sentencing, it's all in one. And in fact, at the beginning of this motion, the government right out of the chute claimed that this is, for all these offenses, this is an offense that should not have a DANC, should be eligible for a DANC, shouldn't receive it. Now, I had to convince the trial court that in light of Madera's and Justice Nakayama's footnote, that the motion for DANC should be ruled upon before sentencing. And so the trial court instructed the prosecutor to bifurcate her sentencing slash opposition to the motion and separate them. So I think what really the court should look at is the inference that the trial court relied upon, sexual penetration, lack of remorse, no apology, as finding that supports an inference of future likelihood of reoffending, I think that should not be adopted. And as the court had said a couple of years ago, that, quote, this court quoted, we believe that the legislature intended for the benefits of HRS Chapter 853 to be broadly available to defendants, except where clearly articulated, deliberate exceptions apply. In this case, Justice McKenna pointed out that the legislature are the ones that are going to delineate what is DANC eligible or not. Sexual assault in the fourth degree is DANC eligible. Custodial interference, a misdemeanor, is DANC eligible. The trial court clearly used penetration, sexual penetration, which as a matter of law should not have been used against the defendant in denying the motion. She used lack of remorse and she used basically no apology as inferences that defendant will likely reoffend, and that the welfare of society and in the interest of justice, that she should suffer the penalty imposed by law. I would just like to leave that it's a legislature's policy back in when it extended in 1976, a dank deferred acceptance no contest plea, similarly to a deferred acceptance guilty plea. It says, especially where youth is involved, a record free of a felony conviction, which would foreclose certain educational, professional, and job opportunities may, in a proper case, be more conducive to offender rehabilitation and crime prevention than the deterrent effects of a conviction and sentence. You know, in this case, this trial court has a very, I'd say, limited view of what discretion is. And she has a record of basically not as this court has found way back in 1976. I want to point out in closing, State versus Martin.
Mr. Lulli, Justice Nakayama has a question. Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Lulli, can you respond to Mr. Ross' argument about your client not being a one-time offender because the two offenses were committed 7 months apart?
Well, if you read the pre-sentence report closely, my client denied this and explained the situation, what happened.
Wait a minute. She pled to these, right?
Yeah, but she pled no contest. And so if you look at the police report, she basically made a statement, and the complainant showed up on her own when my client, petitioner, and her girlfriend went out for the evening. And you look at the facts of how it is presented in the pre-sentence report, and you look at the position of my client giving the statements to the police. There is no connection.
There was no allegation. Why did you let her plead no contest to it?
You know, facing Justice Nakayama, a sexual assault in the first degree.
I'm talking about custodial interference. That was 7 months apart from the sex assault one. I understand that this is a great deal, sex assault one to sex assault four. But there's a custodial interference that she pled to that occurred 7 months later.
That was part and parcel, Your Honor, was settled in this case. She was charged with four counts. We were able to get two of the felonies and the major felony reduced to two misdemeanors. And that's the best the defense could do instead of going to trial and risking, as Justice Edens talked about, a substantial period of her life. And so that's what we were stuck with. But there's no connection.
Can I ask you, with regard to that custodial interference charge, the pre-sentence report contains reports from the guardians, the two guardians, as well as photographic evidence of the hickeys. Is it your position that the trial court could not look at that evidence and then make a determination that in fact there was culpable conduct, you know, culpable behavior by your client on that occasion, and then take that into account in factoring the overall assessment of the appropriate disposition of the motion? In other words, what I'm hearing you say, it sounds like that you think because the defendant pled no contest, the court has to accept her version of what happened. Is that your position?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that you look as this trial court had before it, all of the information, including defendant's background, reputation, character references, and you look at her age, and you look at two misdemeanor convictions, and you weigh that against the policy that this court has really set forth, that when the legislature gives an act of grace, you want it basically to apply across the board to benefit everyone. This is the type of case. A dank plea is to benefit those who should receive the benefit. Now, the trial court had every opportunity that it could, if a defendant does not comply with any of the multiple restrictions or additions as to deferral period, including up to 1 year in jail, that they're not deserving of having a conviction-free record. 27-year-old with a really no criminal record. You would think that, given the policy of the act of grace, that the trial court would not skew her discretion so narrowly as to add up these emphasis of penetration, this custodial interference, and say, that is enough, then I'm going to deny you the benefit that the legislature has given to people who fall within that category as a matter of law. And I think that was a clear abuse of discretion. And it asked that, getting back to just finally, Judge Steve.
Well, Mr. Lulli, Justice McKenna has a question.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Lulli, I want to make sure I understand your position. With respect to October of 2017, I understand that count three actually was charging some sort of like attempted sexual assault or sexual contact as of with respect to October 27, 2017. But that's one of the counts that was actually dismissed. So I'm wondering, is this court able to consider sexual conduct or alleged hickeys for October 7, 2017 in terms of deciding in terms of the issue of whether or not the DENC should have been granted? I'm kind of getting kind of confused. Is it your argument that if something is charged but dismissed, the court cannot consider it in terms of whether or not to grant deferral?
I think just a matter of general due process concerns. If a count is dismissed, it's off the table. It's not charged. Now, when you look at...
So you would argue that we cannot consider hickeys for October of 2000, or the court could not consider hickeys in October.
I'd say if it was dismissed, if it was dismissed, it would be a denial of due process to consider it and use it against the petitioner. And more, and in addition, Your Honor, it contradicts the broad policy of giving classes of people, such as where my client fits in, the benefit of having, it's the benefit of society to have these people conducive to rehabilitation. And I think that in this case, if I could just end with State versus Martin, 1975 case, that's when Justice Acobo was a public defender. He tried to get a motion for DENC granted. The trial court basically wouldn't even hear it. But this court said, reverse the denial of the DENC, and State said this, quote, normally there is no readily available yardstick or measuring device to determine whether a court has exceeded its authority or acted beyond the bounds of reason or disregarded rules or principles of law to the substantial detriment of a litigant in arriving at a decision. Then it got into talking with the DENC, but it ends with, by blind adherence to predetermined rigid conduct, the court precluded any enlightened and just resolve of the criminal charge placed against the defendant. In this case, this trial court has almost effectively such a rigid conduct of precluding DENC. Medeiros is an example 2 years ago. And then you look at what the trial court ruled upon and what she relied upon, sexual penetration, which shouldn't have been relied upon, a lack of remorse or apology shouldn't be relied upon, in contrast with all of her total background, which the pre-sentence report said, not likely to reoffend, I think this court can well find it was an abuse of discretion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lulli, and thank you to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki'e hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.